evening. We'll read from Canto 1, Chapter 4, Texts 9 through 13. I'm getting there, so the first canto's all covered, all recorded. So, Chapter 4 is entitled Appearance of Sri Narada, and these verses that we'll be reading is like a prelude to the appearance of Sri Narada. Chapter 3 ended the answers of the sages, answers of Sutta to the sages, including the final verse, which is the appearance of Srimad Bhagavatam is that which the Lord made the arrangement for, the shelter of religious principles to protect people of this age of Kali. Because one of the questions was, now that Krishna's gone, where's protection? Where's shelter? In the form of religious principles, because the age of Kali is just the opposite. The Bhagavatam is that. The questions, then, Chapter 4 begins with questions, and Shonaka, who's described as elderly, he's described as vastly learned, he's described as a Brahmana who gives shelter to 10,000 student sages. He's like, he's up here. But he's, although he has all these qualifications, he's at the feet of Suta Goswami, who's by birth not even a pure Brahmana. So, what's going on? By those kinds of considerations, it should be the other way around. But the consideration is because he's vastly learned. Excuse me, because he's heard from Shukadeva Goswami. And not only from the first chapter, not only he heard it, but he's understood it. Not only he's understood it, but he's assimilated it. He's a walking Srimad Bhagavatam. And so there, all the sages, including Shonaka, are at his feet and are eager, because they've heard the essence in those six answers to their six questions. They're eager. This is their qualification. The qualification of a listener is their eagerness to hear. And the due respect that goes to the speaker. So Prabhupada discusses how an audience needs to be discriminating who you hear from. And when you find the proper person to hear from, the qualification of eagerness to hear. And the distinction, one of the distinctions of the qualification of Sutta is that he mentioned already, he heard, he's just understood, he's assimilated this message. And an apparent disqualification, which is going to come up in the verses of this morning, so I'm going through this section for review purpose, but Sutta, who was Sutta Goswami's father? Ramaharshan. What was Ramaharshan's special service? What was he expert in? Huh? Yeah, the fifth part of the Vedas, the Puranic portion. Vyasadeva, when he compiled the Vedas, he assigned, okay, you're in charge of the Rig, you're in charge of this one, that one, Veda. And Ramaharshan, Vyasa's student, he put in charge of the Puranic portion, the fifth Veda, the Smritis. Sutta was his son. Ramaharshan was born of a pratiloma marriage, where his mother was a brahmana and his father was a kshatriya. So as a son, he's considered to be of the same quality as his mother, so he was a brahmana, and he was vastly learned, and so on. Vyasa accepted him as a disciple, but born of a pratiloma marriage. And no one concerned themselves with that until he offended Balaram. And then people were reminded, oh yes, this is his position. So Sutta, in turn, was of that same not pure Brahmin born, but qualified, vastly qualified. But what he didn't know, because his qualification was he heard from Shukadeva Goswami, what he didn't know was the four Vedas, or specifically the pronunciation of the mantras of the four Vedas. That he didn't know. And we're going to hear some more about that this morning. But that was not, and by the sages of that time, headed by Shaunaka, the vastly learned Shaunaka didn't consider that. It's not like it's zero, but it isn't considered important in relation to his having heard from Shukadeva Goswami. It was less important. So the application for us is, Prabhupada didn't make emphasis on we must learn Sanskrit and the proper pronunciation of the sacrificial mantras, although that's part of the Vedas. He didn't train us and instruct us and put that in front of us as something that we needed to hear and learn. Although that's needed in society, and some persons may need to know how to do that and fine. That'll be discussed more in this morning's set of classes. So the sages headed by Shaunaka, being very enthusiastic to hear from Sutta, they ask three categories of things. One is, the Srimad Bhagavatam that appeared just after Krishna's departure, can you describe how it appeared? Why was it that Vyas, who had already completed all of the Vedas, again wrote this other literature? Can you describe this? Then the second thing they speak about is Shukadeva Goswami's qualification. And that's where we ended at text 8. What are the qualifications of a speaker of the message of Bhagavatam? Then what are the qualifications of the receiver of the message of Bhagavatam? That's this morning. And so that's Maharaj Pariksha. The glories of Maharaj Pariksha. This is chapter 4. And those of you that are a little familiar with Canto 1 know that Sutta Goswami didn't get around to answering chapter 4 question, this particular part of chapter 4 question, because the others take several chapters and others take several chapters. So it's 16, 17, and 18, three chapters dedicated to describe Maharaj Pariksha. But it's not like, you know, like you might do a paper. You're saying something at the beginning of the paper, we're going to speak about these things, and then later on you speak about one of those things. But he speaks about it. And it's a very important subject. Why is Maharaj Pariksha so important? We'll hear some of the glories of Maharaj Pariksha, but he's a pure devotee. And as a pure devotee, he's important. He's Krishna is very dear to him, and he's very dear to Krishna. So that's Krishna Katha. And another reason that Maharaj Pariksha is particularly important is in this first canto. The other parts also, it expands on it, but the qualities of what's a qualified Brahmana, what's a qualified Kshatriya? Because in the age of Kali, we don't have role models. So, who's qualified? And Prabhupada said, in a desert, a castor plant looks like a tree. But a castor plant's not a tree, it's a castor plant. So, who's a qualified king? What does a qualified king do? What are those things that make him qualified? So at least we have a role model. This is the standard. And not that the idea in the Bhagavatam is, okay, we want to reinstitute divine kings. It's not going to happen in the age of Kali. But leadership is always going to be there because there's people. And as soon as you have people, you have someone's going to take some responsibility in terms of that group. It's just design. That's like, I mean, God's design. There are divisions of society, Krishna says. Chatra Varna Maya Srishtam Guna Karma Vibhagasha. Krishna created that. It's not like Prabhupada was persuading Professor Katovsky. You say classless society in Russia. Communism is classless society. But here's what I see. Going for my morning walk, I see a lady sweeping in the street in the early morning before everyone gets hustle bustle. She's a sweet sweeper. Street sweeper. And in comes the limousine, zoom, zoom, with a big man and a big, big limousine going off to the Kremlin. And your professor sitting in a big office. I see divisions of society in your classless society. And why is it so? Because Krishna has created it. So they may not have a clear recognition, understanding of what that is, but it's there. Because Krishna created it. So those who are to be the intellectuals, those that are to be leaders, those that are to be productive class, those that are to be the helpers. What's your role model? What's the standard? How is it best done? How do the pieces fit together so that you don't have clash? Especially important is Brahmana and Kshatriya and the relationship between the two. First canto, strong component. Third canto, strong component. Because to have a progressive society, those two have to be exemplary and able to function together properly, nicely. When that's there, society, the whole society can be progressive. At least those who follow those leaders. If the leaders are qualified in the Kshatriya Brahmana groups, Shonaka is one. He's qualified. He has 10,000, not just. Imagine. It's hard to imagine. You know, teach 15 people. Okay, that's challenging. And then, you know, 100, you know, teach in a classroom with a lecture hall sometimes, several hundred. Okay, several hundred. 10,000, and they're all sages. You know what that means? They've all got their ideas. That's what it means. And they accept one person. I mean, Shonaka's a leader, but he's exhibiting he's showing us by example, here's the characteristics, here's the criterion of speech and conduct and qualities. And Sutta, who he respects. It's very instructive. Okay. So, this morning section is about Maharaj Parikshit. I heard something, questions about the appearance of the Bhagavatam, the glories of Shukadeva Goswami, so he's going to be spoken about in chapter 19, and then Maharaj Parikshit. Text number 9. Shonaka is speaking to the sages, and he is excited. It was Sutta, Sutta, Mahabaho. So, Acharyas say, he was enthusiastic. Prabhu, Prabhu, please tell me. He wants to hear about Maharaj Parikshit. It is said that Maharaj Parikshit is a great first-class devotee of the Lord, and that his birth and activities are all wonderful. Please tell us about him. That's pretty wide open question. So it gets answered. So it's from his birth and his activities are wonderful. So Prabhupada comments. In what ways was he wonderful? Well, he was wonderful because he chastised Kali, who was attempting to kill a cow. I mean, that's pretty amazing, even to encounter. We're in the age of Kali, to encounter the personality of Kali, to chastise the personality of Kali, to have a raised sword ready to kill the personality of Kali, in the age of Kali. Wow. Very unique. And attempting to kill a cow, well, actually it was a bull, but the protection of cows and bulls is an essential feature of administration. His death was also wonderful because he got previous notice of his death, which is wonderful for any mortal being. It's not like, you know, you go to a doctor and he says, oh, you've got cancer, you have 3 months left to live. But he was, you know, virile and healthy, but, you know, that moment of your death is going to be boom. So, and then what he did with that death notice is also glorious. He prepared himself for passing away by sitting down on the bank of the Ganges and hearing the transcendental activities of the Lord. During all the days that he heard the Bhagavatam, he did not take food or drink, nor did he sleep a moment. Try that. He was very qualified. And before his birth, he directly saw the personality of Godhead. Who can claim that one before you're born, while still in the womb? The Lord comes and, here I am. It was like that because Krishna could have protected him without showing himself, but he wanted to show himself that Maharaj Parikshit was so dear to him. And when his devotee, like Maharaj Parikshit, is put into difficulty, it gives such reassurance, and so he did. And then the invincible Brahmastra weapon. The invincible was checked just to protect his own devotee. So this Maharaj Parikshit is a very special personality. Sutta, you have the qualifications to describe. Please describe. And it's not like the sages, because these are sages, they already knew. There's many questions in the Bhagavatam. Take note of the fact that asking questions about things that you have information on already doesn't mean don't ask that question. But it's not just, you know, they wanted to hear it again, especially. Although hearing again and again and again something that's transcendental is also enlightening. But in the assembly of Vaishnavas, to take a nice topic and go more deeply in the topic, especially being led in that topic by a qualified, realized speaker, That's very nice. By the way, there's a really nice definition. Where did it go? Yeah, really nice definition of what is realized speaker means. What's the qualification of a realized speaker? It doesn't say that he has to be, you know, an Uttama Adhikari Vaishnava that you can't even see with binoculars or a telescope. That's a realized speaker. It doesn't say that. He says, quoting, you must have full confidence in the previous acharya, and at the same time you must realize the subject matter so nicely that he can present the matter for the particular circumstance in a suitable manner. When doing so, and he puts in italics, the original purpose of the text must be maintained. No obscure meanings should be screwed out of it. Yet, it should be presented in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience that this is called realization. Very nice. So, inquiring about subject matters from some in an assembly where there are such qualified persons, it could be plural, not just one person. Shonaka was also very qualified. But where the subject matter, the essence is preserved, the original purpose is preserved, but for the applicable for the audience, the message is intelligible and interesting without the original purpose being distorted, lost, or any other meanings being, you know, injected. So some more about the glories of Maharaj Parikshit. He was a great emperor and possessed the opulences of his acquired kingdom. So Prabhupada comments in the purport about that is he didn't have to go running around and conquer a bunch of places and become the king. He didn't have to do anything. He inherited the kingdom, and the kingdom was the whole world. And because his grandfather, Maharaj Yudhisthira, was so opulent that the opulence, it rivaled the opulence of the king of heaven, his kingdom was vastly opulent. He was so exalted that he was increasing the prestige of the Pandu dynasty. Why did he give everything up to go sit down on the bank of the Ganges and fast till death? What's going on? Why did that happen? They have some understanding. They know the history. They're not dodos. They know the history. But they want to understand the deeper meaning of, you know, you understand the heart of Maharaj Parikshit. Why, what inspired him in this way? Prabhupada's comments, his administration was going along excellently. The citizens were very happy, he was very happy, everyone had what they required. And he was expanding the good name of his forefathers, the Pandavas. Why abandon that? Consequently, there was nothing undesirable in his opulence and administration. This was, that he gave everything up was astonishing. So please explain. So naturally it's getting at, like, what's the deeper purpose of the life of Maharaj Parikshit, being a pure devotee. It's not something shallow, it's something very deep. He was such a great emperor that all his enemies would come and bow down at his feet and surrender all their wealth for their own benefit. Wasn't with reticence. Oh, I've got to go pay my taxes to the emperor. They were understanding by submitting their opulences and everything to at the feet of Maharaj Pariksit, they would benefit. Not like they would be spared and they could still keep their little kingdom going. Their piety, their well-being would be enhanced. He was full of youth and strength, and he possessed insuperable kingly opulences. Why did he want to give everything up, including his life? So, the opulences are described in the purport. He was a pure devotee, and like Maharaj Yudhisthira, perfectly pious. That is, he abided by all the principles of Dharma. So naturally, when one is like that, opulence comes. And not only opulence comes because of his own qualification, the other kings, they also submitted voluntarily all their opulences. And so his prosperity was unrivaled. Earth was very happy supplying the necessities of milk and grain and vegetables. So, in that department, everything was opulent. And because of his presence, even the rivers and the mountains, the things that rivers and mountains supply, they were also voluntarily, abundantly supplying everything. So, from a material point of view, bounty, plentiful. And he just walked away and gave it all up. And not only that, he gave up his life. Very strange. Very strange. Can you describe how this happened? Then comes even something more surprising. Okay, he's detached. That explains it. But he's not just detached, he's a great devotee. And those who are great devotees are simply concerned with the welfare of others. And he was capable of giving protection to all the others who are dependent upon him, his strong arms and his piety and his virtue. And he walked away from them. So, renounced on his own account, but what about those who are dependent upon him? Those who are devoted to the cause of the personality of Godhead live only for the welfare, development, and happiness of others, which is true. Read it again. Those who are devoted to the cause of the personality of Godhead live only for the welfare, development, and happiness of others. They do not live for any selfish interest. So, even though the emperor, Pariksit, was free from all attachment to worldly possessions, so he had this opulence of detachment, how could he give up his mortal body, which was the shelter for others? Most astonishing. Most astonishing. There's not a selfish interest in him. So if the selfish interest was something, and you know, I don't see reason to carry on anymore, my job is finished, but there's others dependent. How can he leave his dependents? Prabhupada says something very important in the purport. He says, selfishness is either self-centered or self-extended. So the idea of selfishness, we normally think of the first kind. I, me, and mine, that kind of selfishness. And another kind of selfishness is self-extended. Thinking of one's group, whatever that group might be. My family, or my state, or my whatever it is, my species. And then other species are expendable because they're not my species. But, or philanthropy in terms of the body and extensions of the body, rather than on the platform of the soul. He's trying to get your attention. So, selfishness was unknown to Maharaj Parikshit. That's only possible if there's full dedication to the Supreme. That in that case, Krishna's interest is at the center. When Krishna, if it's not Krishna's interest fully, if it's not Krishna's interest fully at the center, then our interest is at the center. Do it the other way around. If we are going down the path of life and something comes and we have to make a decision and we're not keeping Krishna's interest in the center, it's going to be selfishness. And is it fair to say that? And the answer is yes, it's fair to say that. That's because the reality is Krishna is at the center. And just forget Krishna, you've got some other center. And the other center is going to be personal selfishness or extended selfishness. Because Krishna is not at the center. But the fact of the matter is, Krishna is at the center. And that's the way to bring check, once again, to the imbalance of values of life, is put Krishna at the center. Something else that's contrived without Krishna at the center, it's selfishness in the name of doing things for others. That's our Srimad Bhagavatam's perspective. Now I want to read a part of one paragraph that struck me as very nice. It's here's an ideal king. Why do we want kings and why do we want good ones? The Supreme Lord, so it starts God-centered. The Supreme Lord wants all living beings to be obedient to Him and thereby become happy. That's the starting point. Therefore, the king's interest is to guide all subjects back to the kingdom of God. So it's a very high service to become a king. Hence, the activities of the citizens should be so coordinated that they can, at the end, go back home, back to Godhead. Under the administration of a representative king, the kingdom is full of opulence. At that time, the human beings need not eat animals. There is ample food, grains, milk, fruit, and vegetables, so that the human beings, as well as the animals, can eat sumptuously, and to their heart's content. If all living beings are satisfied with food and shelter and obey the prescribed rules, there cannot be any disturbance between one living being and another. Emperor Parikshit was a worthy king. Therefore, all were happy during his reign. Very simple explanation. But the focus of what the ultimate purpose of the human form of life is intact. And even so, when it gets down to little worldly things, those things are towards this end. And a king administrates accordingly. And the citizens are protected accordingly and progressively move along that path. And so connecting this to the verse, the sages were saying, Maharaj Pariksit was capable of doing that. This, the people were doing that. They were progressively going, you know, making their march back to Godhead, and the instrument for that was the body of Maharaj Pariksit, and he gave it up. How could he do that? And the last verse for this morning is, we know that you are expert in the meaning of all subjects except some portion of the Vedas, and thus you can clearly explain the answers to all the questions we have just put to you. So in the purport, Prabhupada describes there's a difference between the Vedas and the Puranas. And he says the difference between the Vedas, the four Vedas, and the Puranas, the fifth Veda, is like the difference between the Brahmanas and the Parivrajakacharyas. So what the Brahmanas do is they're expert in the Vedas, they're expert in... the Brahmanas are meant to administer some fruitive sacrifices mentioned in the Vedas, but the Parivrajakacharyas, or learned preachers, are meant to disseminate transcendental knowledge to one and all. As such, the Parivrajakacharyas are not always expert in pronouncing the Vedic mantras, which are practiced systematically by accent and meter by the Brahmanas, who are meant for administering Vedic rites. Yet it should not be considered that the Brahmanas are more important than the itinerant preachers. They are one and different simultaneously because they are meant for the same end in different ways. So this one should... We don't find this, that there's an imbalance. You know, this one looks towards that one and says, ha. And this one looks towards that one and says, ha. And that's not right. As much as the Puranas shouldn't look at the Vedas shouldn't look at the Puranas and go, ha, because they're Vedic. They each have a function and a purpose by the Lord's design. Then Prabhupada supports this by referring to Jiva Goswami's Tattva Sandarbha, and in that Tattva Sandarbha he makes reference to Madhyandina Shruti. In that Madhyandina Shruti, according to Jiva Goswami, it's mentioned that all the Vedas, namely Sama, Atharva, Rig, Yajur, Puranas, Itihasas, Upanishads, etc., are emanations from the breathing of the Supreme Being. Again, this point. The only difference is that the Vedic mantras are mostly begun with pranava omkar, and it requires some training to practice the metric pronunciation of the mantras. So those that know that metric pronunciation of the mantras may, if there's some misfortune in their life, think with pride, we know this and they don't know this, so we're special. So pride can enter into the heart of such qualified persons, when in fact it's just a service unto others, and that's the mood that they should have. They're fortunate to have some service unto others. And it could go the other way around. You know, those that don't know that think, haha, these people are proud, they don't know the meaning of all these things, and the essence of all these things, and all of that's very nicely explained in the Puranas, and we've received all that knowledge. So pride can be in the heart in that way too. Not good. But that does not mean that the Srimad Bhagavatam is less important than the Vedic mantras. On the contrary, it is the ripened fruit of all the Vedas, as stated before. Besides that, the most perfectly liberated soul, Shukadeva Goswami, is absorbed in the study of the Bhagavatam, although he is already self-realized. So that's coming attractions. That the sages are also astonished that it was mentioned in this chapter already that Shukadeva Goswami was fully Brahman realized. He had zero interest of anything temporary, but he was interested in the Srimad Bhagavatam, so that comes up later. Why? You know, who would have to go study something if you're already self-realized? You're already filled full within yourself and neutral towards anything. So why does he go sit down and study the Bhagavatam? Because it's in relation to the transcendence. He's already on the transcendental platform, not attracted to anything temporary. It's fully transcendental. That's the meaning. Suta Goswami is following his footsteps, and therefore his position is not the least less important because he was not expert in chanting the Vedic mantras with metric pronunciation, which depends more on practice than on realization. Then he concludes this whole section. Realization is more important than parrot-like chanting. Now certainly, if one properly chants, not parrot-like, but in a quality way, that will elevate the chanter, and it will elevate those who hear the chanting. And similarly, those who are followers of Shukadeva Goswami, and that is, they hear the Srimad Bhagavatam from Shukadeva Goswami, as did Suta Goswami hear the Bhagavatam from him, and then repeated it with full realization. You know, Shonaka is at his feet. He knows all the metric and all the Vedic capacity, but he wants this essence. And of the two, the essence is more important. And one may get at it this way, or one may get at it that way, but the essence is what's important. And the Bhagavatam especially wants to give that essence. And the Bhagavatam is not, last point, the Bhagavatam is not just for persons that don't know metric pronunciation, like, you know, the Sutta Goswamis or the rest of the world. It's for the Paramahamsas down to the victims of the age of Kali. It's specifically described as a Paramahamsa literature. Paramahamsa literature is the topmost. So it's accessible by ordinary people, and it's entirely relishable by the Paramahamsas and everybody in between. It's most wonderful literature. So there's the discussion about Maharaj Pariksit. Some of the features of a qualified listener. Any questions or comments? Okay.
You had mentioned that we should keep our interests, our interest should be Krishna's interest and not self-interest. So my question was that usually in life we see that there are two options, A and B, and A will. It's very obvious that A is, you know, towards Krishna and B is towards animal enjoyment. But the attraction for A is lesser than the attraction for B. So, and I want to cultivate more attraction towards A, and I don't know how to do that. It's like I know that A is better than B, but still I feel like I'm wanting B more than A. So I want to know how I can get that desire for keeping Krishna's interests in center and not our interests.
I can give a simple answer and say follow the process of bhakti yoga. vidhis of sadhana bhakti are to accomplish that. The fruit of the vidhis of sadhana bhakti is spontaneous devotion. And even in spontaneous devotion, there's a sadhana. Raganuga sadhana bhakti. So, the vidhis are to assist us to come to that which you know, choosing A. Choosing Krishna's interest. Acknowledging the it's vidhi as a regulation, acknowledging the fact there's this other. There's a mix. Same as discussing in the car ride on the way to State College. Take it for granted that our condition is a mix. And following of vidhi sadhana bhakti is to regulate the other part and to enhance the former part. So follow carefully the vidhis of sadhana bhakti. But no, it's not just doing things. It's not the activity itself, the performance of vidhi sadhana bhakti. It's the spirit behind it. The spirit behind it is to connect with Krishna. You make offerings to Krishna following vidhi sadhana bhakti. Or in Krishna's words in Bhagavad Gita, perform your prescribed duty while always thinking of me. Well, thinking of Krishna is the purpose behind this offering, is to please Krishna. Although I'm very conscious and Krishna is very conscious that mixed in is my own interest, my selfishness. But I can pretend, close my eyes and, you know, deceive myself that doesn't exist. But if I'm acknowledging it does exist, I want it to become more this and less that. But Krishna, this is my position. Please accept this offering. Then you're thinking of Krishna while performing your prescribed duties. And that's the activity part, or as you've said, the decision part. And then the support, that which fuels the for Krishna part, that's your sadhana. So very carefully lay the foundation of sadhana. In your life. And when doing your sadhana, again, it's not just, okay, I got my rounds done, now I can do my other things. It's sadhana should be done in a way that you're reaching out to Krishna, that you're exclusively with Krishna time. And it should be in that mood of being present with Krishna in the form of His holy name, in the form of the Bhagavatam, His literary form, His deity form, etc. Cultivate that very strongly. That will carry you to the for Krishna side. And then the activities that you engage in, as with Maharaj Parikshit, he was the king. That's worldly. But he was doing it entirely for Krishna. There was no selfishness. So you can do things of this world entirely for the pleasure of Krishna. It's possible, it's meant to come to that stage. The cultivation Rupa Goswami describes. Anushilana. Anukulena Krishna Anushilana Bhakti Uttama. Anything else?
Like when we are reading the Bhagavatam, how one thing I feel is like unless there is a sense of relationship with Krishna or, you know, the parampara, it's very difficult to just sort of go ahead. Is that a good approach or?
I'm not sure what you're asking. You have to start somewhere. Wherever you are, that's where you start.
Because my, like, my feeling is like, if I don't feel that relationship...
Well, supposing you don't. You have to start somewhere. I can't start until I feel some relationship. Then you may never start. So you start from wherever you are. The start can be a feeling of humility. My condition is such that I don't even feel a relationship with Krishna. And that's my start. But I want to. And, you know, let's say to be, as long as we're being honest and in humble expressions, to be honest in a humble expression, there must be some hankering for a relationship with Krishna, otherwise someone would be somewhere else doing something else. So there's something there. I can't say nothing. Something. Something more than nothing. Whatever that something is, you start there. So it may not be as strong as I would like it, but something. Adau Shraddha is the statement of Rupa Goswami. Some preliminary faith. There's something beyond this veneer of material existence. There's something far more deep and profound. I have that faith. That's where you start from. And then from that, sadhu sangha. Krishna sends that association. And then in that association, the next, bhajana kriya. It's just leveraging that preliminary faith to a more mature stage. It's taking the seed in the dormant state and sprouting it. And so the seed that's just beginning to sprout could say there's no fruits and flowers yet. Be patient. Continue to sprout, will you? Just keep the bhajana kriya going very nicely. It will come. The mature stage will come. Anything else? Yes?
Maharaj, how can I develop full conviction in Krishna consciousness? Because sometimes I think that, okay, from today I'll be determined and have full conviction. But something or other happens, some events happens, or I'm put into some situations. As a result, I totally forget for determination
for
having a conviction.
Sure. Please read chapter 3 of Madhurya Kandambani and you'll be very happy. Chapter 3 of Madhurya Kandambani is describing there's subdivisions of what you just described. There's 8 different varieties of that one. There's the same, misery loves company. So, what you just described is universal. There's some solace in that. It's not just, I'm weird. This is universal. The stage of anishtita bhakti precedes nishtha. And what precedes anishtita bhakti is this awakening of some attraction. There's enough attraction to make this resolve. So one of the categories of anishtita bhakti is making firm resolve to improve in bhakti that doesn't sustain. There's another one that's firm resolve to rid oneself of something that's interfering with bhakti, and that resolve to rid oneself of something doesn't sustain. There's others. There's six other ones. It's a stage. And in the presentation of Madhurya Kandambani chapter 3 is the obstacle is something unwanted. Anartha. So one has to pass through the anartha nivritti stage before you can get to the nishtha stage. So welcome to the anartha nivritti stage. And part of it is, one side of it is, our resolve is not firm enough. Another part of it is the obstacle is stronger than our resolve. Or at least it appears to be. Because actually, something material can't stop something spiritual. It can't. It's only because we're attached to something material, we're weak in our resolve. And Krishna recognizes you have this other attachment. And my position, Krishna's position, Krishna looking upon that position, says, you know, do you really want me? Well, what about this other thing that you're attached to? So when we become resolved in depending upon Krishna, not just resolve in our effort, because that's ego-based, it's just my effort. My effort has to be strong enough. If our dependency upon Krishna is strong enough, Krishna can, he'll lift us out. But that's the part that's missing. It's not so much our relationship with Krishna, but I don't want this trouble. Or I want a sense of having conquered this challenge of getting beyond this obstacle. Ego-based. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way. Obstacles and spiritual path require purity to remove them. And purity is this full dependence upon Krishna. It's our effort combined with mercy, these two things. We're not sufficiently looking to the mercy of Krishna, and so we're in this anishtita stage. That's spiritual intelligence. That we're dependent. Krishna. Calling from the heart. Krishna. Krishna comes to the rescue. Like Maharaj Pariksit, because it's our topic for this morning. So Maharaj Pariksit is a baby in the womb. What are you going to do when a Brahmastra is coming after you? Krishna! Or you're a cowherd boy and, the serpent is swallowing Nanda Maharaj. So they get the sticks from the fire and, are burning the serpent and beating the serpent and nothing works. Krishna! Krishna comes and places his foot on the serpent's head and it's over. There's a forest fire, etc. There were two forest fires. One of them was after the Kaliya Damana Leela. They slept by the side of the Jamuna River and at night, big forest fire with a raging wind. Krishna, what do you do in a situation like that? So if we think it's my own strength that can take care of the thing. I just have to be sufficiently determined to take, gather up all my strength and focus it against this obstacle, and there, the obstacle's gone. I won. It doesn't work like that. But rather we're distracted by those things that we're attached to instead of Krishna. Therefore, anishtita bhakti. That's why, then, what to do? Gradually, just like this first question, very carefully continue to follow the vittis of sadhana bhakti, and as you're doing so, recognize the purpose behind them is to come to the stage where this full dependence upon Krishna is stronger and material dependence is less. Doesn't mean you throw away your abilities, but you deploy them in service to Krishna and with very strong foundation of sadhana. And, you know, not only the unsteadiness in bhakti, but going forward in your life, all the complexities that are happily awaiting you. Career and marriage and children and family and relatives and, you know, economy and this and that and so many things that are challenging. Same principle described, because the start of it is your relationship with Krishna. The steadiness in that relationship with Krishna will carry you through all those things. Someone else had their hand up. Yes.
So we hear these messages from Srimad Bhagavatam, like purity, full dependence on Krishna, having Krishna the center and all that. And so many times when I'm faced with my own anartha, and it comes right in front of my face, I'm thinking that, oh, okay, this exists in my heart, and then I'm reacting to the situation in a not so Krishna conscious way, and then I'm simultaneously I'm calling out and, you know, I'm telling Krishna.
And cleverness and et cetera, and, you know, dealt with it. And now I've got this other thing that I've received some training in, which is to rely upon the internal potency of Krishna and to try to please Krishna in the manner in which I'm addressing myself to this. Not just be smart, but be devoted to Krishna. And there's this mix going on. So your question is, how can we understand? And my answer was, see how it draws you closer to Krishna. How much more of the, in that mix, how much is there feeling closer to Krishna in that situation that's the crisis or the conflict or the confrontation thing? How much is my thought going to Krishna? And I'm feeling closer to Krishna as a result, or in the midst of this conflicting situation, circumstance. That's how much in that mix is Krishna conscious. As opposed to, in my mind, I've accepted something, but, you know, when it really comes down to it, it was theoretical. Because I'm now being pushed around by circumstance, by the material energy. And I'm not thinking of Krishna. So it was. But even in your own description, to a degree, there's this acknowledgement to Krishna, or speaking to Krishna, that here I am, Krishna, I know what you've said, and I'm just reacting. And I know that you know already, but I'm conscious of you. I'm conscious of the fact that you know. Krishna, please help me. That's to that extent, there's devotion, not just mental acceptance. Like, you know, it's like a small child that maybe, whatever it is, you know, they want something and their parent is saying no. And they're saying to the parent, you know, I know that what you're saying to me is to say no is in my best interest, but I can't help it. I want that something. there's acknowledgement of the parent rather than just pouting or whining or something. They're stuck between the conditioning and the sense of accepting the mercy of their parent. But that's a more mature stage than the other. So it's a transition. These questions have been transition questions because they're honest expressions of where you are. You're in transition. And it's not something to be ashamed of or embarrassed about. It's look at it from the other side. Where were you before that these thoughts weren't there, and now you're in transition trying to nurture these devotional thoughts and devotional mood and Krishna consciousness. It's very nice. The modalities of expression are each different, but that's at the essence. And so one of the things that can be very helpful is stay in close association with those who are similarly, sincerely applying themselves to go the next step. And their strength not just, you know, the buddy system kind of thing, but Krishna is pleased by that. We're not just I'm striving, we're striving. We're helping one another to strive. There's in Krishna conscious relationships, there's strength. That means Krishna. Bala, Jnana, and Kriya. There's spiritual strength. See it the other way around. Go off somewhere where there's no devotee association and try and see what happens. Very difficult. So there's strength in association. And especially, I, as a member of this association, have the responsibility to try to be exemplary, not just for my own salvation, but so I can be a better instrument of service unto others. And each person, in an ideal way, should be, the ideal circumstance, should be thinking like that. It's not just my advancement in Krishna consciousness. I have relationships, and I should be an instrument of Krishna in these relationships with others that are like myself in this in-between phase, in this anishtita bhakti stage. So let me be somehow, it's another prayer to Krishna, let me be an instrument. And it can be one of those prayers that says, well, I know, Krishna, I know I should be that instrument, but, you know, I'm dealing with my own stuff here, so how can I be your instrument? Please help me to be a better instrument in serving the Vaishnavas. And if that mood, this is the key, if the mood of service unto the Vaishnavas is something that one is cultivating, you get more of Krishna's mercy than if you're simply thinking of your own salvation. Very, very important.
Can I ask you?
Yeah.
So, like we were talking, I mean, when I'm in this reactive state, like the brunt of that reaction is mostly borne by persons who are close to me, and which happens to be my husband. And he's very forgiving, and you know, life goes on, and somehow we reconcile, come back, and the same thing happens. But then, when I extend that, others might not be so forgiving, and the relationships might just fall apart. Although there is acknowledgement that, you know, from both sides, there is this, we are in the stage of anathanivriti, and everyone is like trying hard, and still something remains in the heart, like.
So what to do, huh? There is this saying that Prabhupada would repeat to err as human, to forgive as divine. So it's a Vaishnava quality that each one of us needs to imbibe, you know, the divine quality of forgiveness. And that's one of the standards of friendship. If we're going to have real friendship, like, you know, the real kind of friendship, not just in name, but a real friendship, is acknowledging, as with myself, here's another person that has some shortcoming. I know that shortcoming. They know that I know that shortcoming. And I accept it. And at the same time, in a gentle way, I'm just now rephrasing something that I have on my desk in New York and Chicago, and it just sits there. And still in a very gentle and caring way, I offer some assistance to go the next step. That's a friend. So, let me be that person unto others. Let me be that friend. And if others are not feeling in that same disposition, that's out of my jurisdiction. But that shouldn't stop me from being a friend. These are really basic things, like the golden rule. Do unto others. You know that golden rule, right? It's described in all, there's a web page, a Do Unto Others web page, where all the scriptures of the world, you know, Sufism, thisism, and thatism, they all have, it's a very fundamental ethic or something of life. That as you would want others to do to you, do that unto others. So just be what I just described as what a friend is unto others. Even if they may not, whether or not, unconditional, whether or not they're behaving that way towards you. You just pray to Krishna for that strength, and the prayer to Krishna can be, I know this is what I want to be, and there's attachments and things in my heart that's making it hard, but Krishna, please help me be that unto others. And by so doing, you create a culture. You're part of creating a culture. Not you create a culture, but it's part of creating a culture. The culture of friendship. Where, just as this discussion this morning has gone, there are others who are in this, those things will be there, but the higher commitment is to the relationship. And so those things get worked out. And as your husband sees in you this shortcoming tendency, he sees the greater, which is this commitment towards purity. And so when that other thing is going on, it's okay because he's committed to the relationship and sees this other commitment. And so you work things out and let that become the fabric of the relationship with others. It's part of the socialization of our international society for Krishna consciousness in whatever the group is. So you've got this little incubation chamber where you're learning the art of how to become Krishna conscious in the association with another. And, you know, Krishna has sent each of you into this association by his arrangement. And some dynamics may be easier because, you know, this is our cup of tea and that isn't. This suits my nature and that doesn't. So some may be easier, some may be more challenging. But let that be the culture. Strive for that. within the means that Krishna has given you. That means, by within the means, by that I mean to say, like this statement, you begin somewhere, wherever you are. So your capacity may be, or anyone's capacity may be here. Another's capacity may be here, another's capacity may be here. I have my capacity. Let me strive within my capacity. If I'm falling short, my apology for falling short, the first apology goes to Krishna. But at least, even if I'm falling short, that doesn't mean I give up, I quit, I can't do this anymore. I'm falling short. You continue to strive, depending upon Krishna's mercy to bless the sincere effort. Because without Krishna's mercy, we're finished. But fortunately, we have Krishna's mercy if we continue to be sincere. And then that unsteady bhakti moves more towards steady. That's how it works. It's the two things, the continued effort and the calling for Krishna's mercy. Not just one or just the other, but both. Gradually, using that same metaphor again, the seed is now fructifying and it's still very delicate. This little seedling, too much heat or too much cold or too much something, extremes of something can really shake the well-being of that little seedling. So we try to, as much as possible, keep conditions suitable, conducive, and trust that in course of time that little seedling will grow and sprout and become stronger and the fruits and flowers will come in time. Just continue nurturing that growth of the little creeper of bhakti in ways that Rupa Goswami has given us, those that are guiding and training you are supporting, and continue. And the mature stage will come. And as your husband is forgiving of you when those things happen, and others may be or may not be, you continue to grow with, adhering to the teachings that Rupa Goswami has given under proper guidance. Trusting in Krishna. Those who are faithful will continue to make progress, and those whose faith is weak may not be able to continue. So we want to nurture our faith. It's very, especially in the beginning, it's Rupa Goswami teaches it's fragile. It's pliable. So we need strong association. So your mentors are providing that nice, strong association to keep that faith strong and going, growing. And regularly having nice kirtan and hearing Srimad Bhagavatam's message, that's so on, that's also nurturing faith. Nice discussion this morning so far. Anything else? Yes?
Maharaj, sometimes we are faced with a situation where you have to go against your nature to do something right. It is right and you do it. Finally, but the stress, the mental stress that you go through is like sometimes too much. And then again you're faced with another situation and you remember the stress that you've previously gone through when you don't want to do something right then. I mean, how do I still do it right? I mean, I remember the stress that I go through and I said, no, I give up, I can't take this. because that stress affects other things too.
Sure. You probably have something specific in your mind, but you don't need to share it. He probably knows what it is too. This is another Anishtita Bhakti dilemma. In those circumstances, a very valuable, extremely valuable resource is a close relationship with those who are guiding you in your Krishna consciousness. Because when those, not just, you know, like a safety valve, when those pressure moments come, then they can blow off some steam or something. But a sense of connectivity so that the good things as well as those things you can share openly and you feel support. You're not just alone. This horizontal or peer kind of association may also be that kind of resource. But the same, it's our process is a descending process. And we may often see our friends as persons we can lean on more than we can see our friends as also bearers of Krishna's mercy. But when there are those who are superiors to us and there's a close relationship with someone who's superior to us, we're looking for mercy, and you know, when that receptivity for mercy is, we're going to get mercy. I mean, you're getting mercy even if you're not receptive, but you'll get more of it. So those relationships will help you through that unsteady stage. It's a little bit like Prabhupada's example of when you plant a small tree or a garden. You put a fence around it. What's the purpose of the fence around it? Is to keep other entities from coming and perhaps damaging or even destroying that thing that you're trying to grow. So you make a little fence. So like a little tree, they put a little fence. But after the tree has grown up big and strong, the fence isn't needed anymore. So especially in this phase, having strong relationships with those who are carefully nurturing and guiding your Krishna consciousness will be enormously helpful. You're not alone. You're not alone in, as you're hearing. I mean, I'm hearing. You're hearing that there are persons going through the same thing that you're going through. So I'm not... This little episode is not something isolated. It's, you know, we're all going through, but still I got to live my life, so now what do? So there's some support in knowing that others are also going through similar things, but I need additional support, and that's these strong relationships. And it's not that, one difference between the comparison with the little fence around the little tree, when our devotion becomes mature, more mature, it's not like, okay, see you later. And, you know, those relationships become even deeper because there are further things to help us progress in Krishna consciousness that those who are more advanced than us can help us. Right now we're dealing with stuff down here. They can help you further. Last point in response is that one of the things that those persons who are helping to guide you will do is help you to access resource that's within yourself, your own deeper convictions, as opposed to the conditionings that says, ouch, it hurts. And even I know this hurt is less than that hurt, it still is ouch. So they'll help you access some deeper faith and conviction. And when that deeper faith and conviction is there, it's like, you know, when there's love, supposing you're in summertime and you're in a hot kitchen and you're cooking, if the service that you're doing is out of love for someone that you're cooking for, it doesn't affect you the same way. And if it's not like that, then it's, you know, it's just hot, and I don't like being in this hot kitchen in the summer. The austerity of the circumstance becomes more overwhelming. And when there's a deeper love and purpose, let the mentor help you access and resource that higher state of consciousness so you can pass through that temporary phase. Happily. It's not very satisfying to just hear,
well, that's purification, boo.
But it's true, it's purification. It's true, it's purification. But there needs to be something deeper than that in order to really feel satisfied. It's true. It's purification. You know, if you have a boil and it hurts, so somebody lances the boil, and the lancing of the boil may hurt. Well, it's to relieve the toxins that are within your body. It's for purification. Yeah, but it still hurts. So some deeper sense of why you're doing what you're doing, reconnecting with that deeper sense of devotion.
Especially when you're interacting with people who are not devotees. You know, we live in this world, we get to interact with them more than this, unfortunately. So, how do we cultivate that compassion and empathy, understanding?
Two answers. One is we had a... In Gita Nagari, we had a retreat for 3 days just on this one topic. So a lot of rich things came out of that. When you go listen to those recordings, that's one answer. Another answer is seeing on the platform of the soul. If you see on the platform of the soul, cultivate seeing on the platform of the soul, you can understand this person is suffering. This behavior that's despicable, it's harassing, it's hurtful, it's harsh, it's... Whoa. It's because the soul is suffering. They're exhibiting this behavior from that place of suffering. The behavior may be, you know, abominable, like condemnable. But the soul, look at the soul. And then you can feel compassion for the soul. And then think, the next thought is, in service, what can I do to help this soul? At least, let me pray to Krishna, you know, somehow help put out their fire. The fire of material existence is engulfing this person. And my little sprinkling of water isn't going to do anything to put out that person's fire. Krishna. For that well-being of that person. And that can be challenging. Just to stay on the platform of the soul can be challenging. Therefore, we have Bhagavad Gita and our scriptural teachings to help us stay fixed, at least conceptually. And then comes these challenges, like Prasanna Mataji was saying, that, you know, well, we know, but still it's hard. The stage of that our convictions are not deep enough yet, or on the spiritual platform yet, sufficiently. Okay. Thank you very much.